case for this morning is Ott against the City of Milwaukee. I don't think so. Shanti Ott. And we'll hear from Mr. Moriarty for the state.
Thank you, Your Honors. Richard Browse Moriarty, Wisconsin Department of Justice. I represent two agencies, two state agencies, as to whom non-party subpoenas were directed by the plaintiff in contexts outside of any witness setting. There are four issues before the court, one involving appellate jurisdiction and then three on the merits.
So why don't you start with appellate jurisdiction, since many of us love that topic.
Yes. I believe the question of appellate jurisdiction here is answered by the court's precedent. Delwood Farms, plain...
You need to incorporate Mohawk into the... I mean, obviously, much as we love this court, the Supreme Court calls the shots, and Mohawk is the Supreme Court's most recent extended treatment of this sort of appellate jurisdiction.
It is. However, Mohawk Industries addressed a party issue, privilege involving a party, and this court in Sandra T.E., and other courts since Mohawk have looked at, other circuit courts since Mohawk have looked at the Mohawk Industries case and said, in a non-party setting, Mohawk Industries does not necessarily call the shots.
But it does have guidance about, let's say, what the threshold of importance needs to be before an appeal in the middle of a case can go forward. And what this court and many others have done is they have said, before we're going to let, even in a civil case, this sort of non-party opposition to a subpoena be tested, you've got to, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You've got to be found in contempt.
You know, that's correct as a general matter, that some courts have gone that way. Some other circuits have gone that way and said, nope, you can't appeal until there's contempt. This court has held to the contrary and said you have that right to appeal.
But let me offer you an analogy, and it's really just an analogy, and that's to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37, which is the general rule, as I'm sure you know, that deals with discovery orders, discovery sanctions. And so step one is you go under 37A and you get an order compelling discovery. And only when there's noncompliance with that order do you go to step two and you really get to the point of some kind of compulsory action by the court, some punitive action, taking facts, contempt, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, let's say even in your case, if this had moved beyond the standoff that the parties came to and a contempt, you know, show cause order had been put before the court. Sometimes things get narrowed. Sometimes the court takes a more focused look at it. So I have a feeling of almost unripeness to this appeal. We don't know how this finally would have been resolved.
Excellent point, Your Honor, and the analogy, too, because there with 37, we're talking about parties who have disobeyed
actually
orders.
37 also covers non-parties.
That is correct in the sense.
It does.
But what we have here, Your Honor, is one rule that applies, Rule 45, in a subpoena setting outside of the state agency being required, for example, to present a witness or anything of that nature. In the contempt setting, this is an interesting point. What is the state agent? What happens if a state agency is brought to the contempt level? You can't put the state agency in jail. What are the options that are available? Can you fine the state agency? The case law and bankruptcy and others, for example, say no. That implicates 11th Amendment immunity to be fining a state agency, for example, for violating a stay order, a bankruptcy stay order, that kind of
thing.
There's
an odd implication to your argument. Well, actually, there are a number of odd implications to your argument. One of them is that you seem to concede, I think, because of the way that Rule 30 was amended some time back, that if this had been a subpoena to this person who was named in the subpoena, and it was a subpoena duces tecum, so the person was going to have their deposition taken, but maybe the only thing that was going to be said in the deposition was, you know, do you work for the Wisconsin Crime Lab? Yes, I do. You know, what's your job? I'm the whatever. I'm the records keeper. And did you bring all the documents along with you that we asked you to bring? I take it you would concede that that is a perfectly acceptable subpoena because it's hooked on to a deposition.
Well, not just that. Had a subpoena been directed to a person, a human being, bring the documents, that would have solved this issue. But instead it was to...
This was, I'm going to have to find it.
Yeah, they were served by certified mail to individuals.
Actually, it was to an agency,
care of
an individual. And the district court specifically found that these were directed to state agencies.
So why does that matter? I mean, I'm looking at the one, this happens to be at page 25, appendix 25 of the opening brief, to Wisconsin State Crime Laboratory, care of Lou Wilsinski. So here we have Lou Wilsinski's name in the subpoena, and he or she works at the Wisconsin State Crime Laboratory. Your argument is so, ineffectual in the end, it seems to me.
Your Honor, when a subpoena is a command of the court.
So Lou Wilsinski is being told, you know, you're getting this for the Wisconsin State Crime Laboratory.
Actually, Your Honor, when it is, here's the entity, care of so-and-so, is Mr. Wilsinski being ordered, commanded to produce documents, or is he just getting it and supposed to do something with it? It becomes very confusing. It's precisely why a subpoena, and this gets to that.
What's it that you don't get about this? I mean, I just don't see where, if you want everything you're asking for, what possible significance it would have. I mean, you agree that, I mean, I don't know, maybe you're trying to play some game, some shell game, so that somebody's supposed to guess, well, maybe it's Lou Wilsinski, maybe it's John Jones, maybe it's Mary Smith, maybe it's somebody else, and so you keep saying, oh, you found the wrong person again.
Not at all, Your Honor. There's certainly no shell game here at all. This, whether or not a state is a person, is a significant issue in and of itself in the law.
But listen to this. I mean, you know, your argument that a state is not a person for purposes of the procedural rules is really stunning in that it suggests that you want a system in which states never have to produce discovery to anybody and other people always have to produce discovery. And that would lead to a litigation system that was extremely unfair, imbalanced, a version of sovereign immunity I've never heard of. I could certainly see a rule under which maybe the state's immunity had to be assessed in light of what was the underlying claim. If it was a direct lawsuit against the state under will, as of course we all know, the states aren't persons, you know, fine. But your argument proves an awful lot.
Well, Your Honor, it's not our argument that the state documents cannot be obtained. It is a simple matter
of
serving a subpoena
argument
on a human being. That's what's allowed under Rule 45. You serve it on the secretary of the department, for example.
But it doesn't say human being in Rule 45.
It says person. And when you have person used in a statute or a rule, you apply and... we're talking about a sovereign entity, you apply the presumption that person is not included. That's been the rule, as indicated in all the cases we've cited.
Our opponents, of course, cited a whole different set of cases.
They look at the Nardone case. They look at the Yusoff case.
And Nardone was contemporaneous with the issuance of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
It was, and the position of the Yusoff case of Ott and the district court is that the presumption only applies in a couple of very narrow settings.
Well, they may not be so narrow. Be careful what you wish for. I mean, I think you may be here next week saying that they're very broad.
Fair enough. Two settings, let's put it that way, broad or narrow. But the Singleton panel clearly got that wrong. in its interpretation of Nardone.
Singleton was about whether, you know, you were always violating the rules when you offered leniency to a witness, and everybody immediately said that's, you know, the whole system would crumble if that were the case.
That's
that
correct.
Was a very however, different issue.
However, in Nardone, in the Singleton case, they relied on the same interpretation of Nardone. That was rejected by courts across the country, including this court and the D.C. District Court, before Yusof. Yusof did not even mention the Ramsey case. So we've got the presumption that the sovereign immunity, the sovereign is not a person. So how do we get there that the state agency becomes a person under Rule 45?
Well, if you have to go there, I'm going to just warn you that you're in your rebuttal time, so this is your call. If you would like to use it now, be my guest.
Thank you. Any other questions on appellate jurisdiction first? Okay. On the person issue, I'll talk further about that in rebuttal if need be. On the personal service issue, court precedent requires that these subpoenas be personally served, and this one was not.
The post office officer who stands there and personally gives it to them and gets their signature, not a person who is personally giving it to the individual?
Personal service has always meant a process server or someone along that lines.
The subpoena rule doesn't say that you have to go get a stamp on your forehead saying you're a process server.
Well, the Barnhill case indicated that a subpoena served by certified mail was defective and needed to get there in its analysis, so that was a holding. The Collins case looked at the situation and said, you know, maybe Congress should look at imposing costs for people that refuse personal service, the implication being personal service is required. The York group
just
case.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about ordinary mail. I fully take the point about that, but certified mail is special. Okay.
I'll reserve the rest. Thank you.
Hear more from you. Ms. Horn.
Good morning. My name is Gail Horn, and I represent the plaintiff, Shantae Ott. The district court got it right when it ordered the appellants to comply with plaintiff's subpoenas. There, in a thorough opinion, the district court considered the objections that they raised, rejected them, and there's no reason to disturb the district court's opinion. In fact, this court doesn't even have the authority to disturb the district court's opinion because there isn't jurisdiction over this appeal.
So what about Mr. Moriarty's point that holding the state agency in contempt would raise a significant constellation of issues about the ability to force them to pay fines? I mean, you're not going to throw the crime lab in prison. I don't quite know what that means.
Well, I don't think that there would have to be a finding of criminal contempt in order to have a finding of contempt under Rule 45.
Civil contempt certainly can involve jail time.
Your Honor, I think that Rule 45 would not impugn the 11th Amendment sovereignty. I think if you look at some of the other rules that have found a state to be a person, for example, Rule 14 or Rule 19, there would certainly be the opportunity to hold the state in contempt under those, you know, if they were a party to the litigation, for example.
Right, but what I'm trying to get at is, following your appellate jurisdiction argument based on Mohawk and extensions from that reasoning, is the idea, if it were not the state, that you need to wait and disobey the order and have some kind of sanction imposed against you before the case is ripe for an appeal. And this is all assuming you're non-party, you know, and all the rest of that. And so I'm trying to figure out, as a practical matter, how would that work in your situation? You've issued subpoenas to these two agencies of the Wisconsin government, and they've they didn't want to comply with the subpoenas. So now what? I mean, what finally makes this ready for an appeal?
I think that the purpose behind contempt, which Mohawk Industries sort of alludes to, is to winnow substantial disputes from disputes that are designed just to delay the litigation. And so I think that there is a function to be had by requiring them to, as you said, put the money where their mouth is. And so if this court were inclined, the case would be sent back down to the district court. And the state agencies, or these individuals to whom the subpoena was directed within the state agencies, would then have the opportunity to decide whether or not they wanted to put their money where their mouth is and disobey.
What penalty, you know, would you think could be imposed if you were the district court judge? The judge has already rejected their arguments. The judge has said, I don't agree with your arguments. You have to comply with the subpoena. And they've now taken an appeal from that order. So it's a very concrete order that we have. So what more does the judge need to do before you think this would be ready for an appeal? Or do you really think this just has to sit there until final judgment?
I don't think it has to sit there until final judgment. I think it's not so much a matter of what the judge has to do as to what the parties have to do. I think they have to say, we are not going to obey this judicial order. And then the judge would then find them. There would be a contempt proceeding and would find them in contempt. Now, the judge...
What if they don't comply with the order and don't talk to you about it?
Well, I think then it would be, the onus would be on us to move for a finding of a rule to show cause. I mean, that situation happens with regard to witnesses who don't show up for depositions under Rule 45
right,
subpoenas.
So they come to rule to show cause, they don't show for that either. Now what do you do?
Well, then I think that what would ultimately happen is that we would then issue, the same way a rule to show cause would work in other contexts. As this court,
it is just a statement of contempt would be enough, because you seem to be saying, well, not a fine, and of course, for the agency as a whole, throwing them in jail until they decide to cooperate isn't really on the table. But do you think the mere statement, now you're in contempt, is enough to make it ready for appellate review?
I think that that's up to the district court to make that determination about what the appropriate...
But if they do, is that what gives us jurisdiction?
Well, I think what gives you jurisdiction is that is a final order. It's a ruling that they've been held in contempt.
My question is yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Goody.
So I don't think that there's jurisdiction over this appeal, but even if there is jurisdiction over this appeal, I think on the merits, the district court's opinion should be upheld. I think the district court made appropriate findings of fact with regard to whether or not a state is a person subject to these subpoenas, and the fact that service by certified mail, which the appellants don't dispute that they actually received the subpoenas, so in this particular case, was sufficient.
Ms. Warren, I want to ask you a very practical question. Given the position that the state has taken, why didn't you run out and take a 30B6 deposition right away to get the data?
Your Honor, we had actually offered to, after they filed their motion to quash, we offered under local rules, and we went to the appellants and said, we'll work with you. We will reissue these subpoenas. We don't believe that your procedural arguments are sound, but we'll go ahead in the interest of, you know, expediting this issue.
Right.
And they said no.
Avoid the whole appeal and get what you need and go on.
They said no. They said, this is a court order, and we are obligated to litigate this issue.
But that doesn't stop you from pursuing the 30B6 deposition.
Your Honor.
And just obviating the whole appellate process.
And if I can take it a step further, they said the only way that we will avoid, they had asked also for fees and sanctions to the tune of over $8,000, and they said the only way that you can avoid us seeking those sanctions is for you to forever, for now and forever, not seek this information in any form. So it's sort of, we could have, I suppose, said we're going to take a Rule 30B6 deposition and go ahead and try to get these documents, but there's no sense that that would have actually worked, because what the appellant said, and some of that correspondence is in the record, is that the only way, we're not going to give this information to you, and if you try to seek it, we're still going to keep with our $8,000 motion for sanctions. So they've refused to produce this information to us and have stated, move for sanctions, and said the only way you can avoid that is if you never seek this information from us, ever. So that puts us in a bind. I mean, these are...
And that sanction motion is still pending.
Well, no, it was part of the amended motion. When they filed their amended motion to quash, they sought, in addition to quashing the subpoena, sanctions or fees for litigating the motion to quash.
And
so
the district court denied
that, correct.
Right. So it's been ruled on. Okay.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
And so that having happened, why not go ahead and get the 30B6 at that point?
Well, Your Honor, at that point, actually after the district court ruled, we tried to have discussions with the defendants about would they produce some of the documents. I mean, some of the stuff...
30B6 isn't Mother May I. 30B6, you just send it, set the date, and then you get it.
Your Honor, but they would not even agree to produce. I mean, some of the stuff we're looking for is bread and butter discovery. I mean, we're looking for Illinois State Police crime lab reports that show Wisconsin State crime lab reports showing that the DNA of the serial killer matched the DNA of 10 homicides.
You feel you're going to win on the merits ultimately, but why take all that time on this appeal, and why not just proceed to 30B6?
I would ask the question of the defendants, the appellants. I mean, there was no way that they were the signal.
How quickly did they appeal after the dismissal? Did you think that jurisdiction had shifted or something?
No, they appealed immediately after the district court issued its order. The district court they filed a motion to amend the district court's order, saying, "Can we assert substantive, what they described as substantive objections?" Before the district court had ruled on that, they filed an appeal. I mean, at that point, once the district court ruled, there would be no point for us to seek a 30B6 deposition because they've already been ordered to produce all of this information to us. And there's no sense that they would have complied with that order.
You're not going to get it until we rule, until we deal with the fairly knotty issues that are in front of us, and then a ruling comes down, and whatever happens after that. Whereas if you proceed on, the case was not stayed, you can proceed on and get what you want and move the litigation along.
I mean, obviously, if the appellants are – we had offered to do this in multiple different ways, and they had refused. So it was my understanding that their position was that they were refusing any sort of new subpoena being issued, any sort of alternative process.
They concede in their papers the 30B6.
And if that concession is true, then we can take a 30B6 deposition, and they will be forced to produce these records. The reason why they're now offering that, though, is because the district court ruled that they had waived all of their objections to producing this information because they failed to bring it in their original motion to quash. So the only reason I believe that they're offering this concession now of saying, hey, go ahead and take a 30B6 and we'll produce this information, is because they want the opportunity, the second bite at the apple, to assert substantive objections to these subpoenas, which the district court clearly ruled had already been waived. And so we believe that, you know, the district court's ruling is sound. It should be upheld on appeal. And certainly there's nothing preventing them from producing these documents to us, some of which are very, like I said, I believe sort of bread and butter documents that you produce in this type of litigation. But the reason why the concession has been made is solely to give them an opportunity to assert these substantive objections to these documents. And so that puts us, obviously, in a different position with regard to the materials at issue here. We're not sure what those substantive objections are. They, despite numerous rounds of briefing in the district court and in this appellate court, they have yet to articulate what those are, other than to say that they have some type of substantive objections that they would later like to assert that don't presumably fall under the rubric of Rule 45's motion to quash, since they've already filed a motion to quash. I see that my time is almost up, but just to conclude, we believe that the states are persons. They should be required to produce these documents. Nardone was issued on the very day that the rules were enacted. The Supreme Court, with one voice, clearly stated that the presumption only applies in these two instances. I would suggest that the cases that they've cited fall into those two categories. Certainly, if you're subjecting the state to liability, or if you're working in obvious absurdity, which is the series of cases dealing with prosecutors and immunity deals, Rule 45 is not that type of rule. The rules should all be read together, and that the courts, including this court, has already determined that states can be persons for purposes of Rule 14, Rule 19, and Rule 30. If there are no more questions.
Apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have a few minutes, Mr. Moriarty. How much time does he have? 2 minutes.
The record will reflect we never refused anything.
So you'd be happy for a Rule 30B6 deposition in which you did not renew these waived arguments?
If there were a 30B6 deposition, then we would take it as it came and deal with it. There are, in fact, privacy interests that are involved here, third-party privacy interests, as reflected by the fact that parties themselves have entered into confidentiality agreements regarding much of the same information. But as far as whether or not we refused, we did not. Ms. Horn said, hey, look, I'll just reissue the subpoenas, period. And I had an argument there about fees, and I said, well, you haven't even mentioned the fee issue. So give me a proposal. I'll be glad to consider it. We never said fees would be required. I just said you hadn't paid attention to that. She never followed through. That's what the record reflects. So as far as whether or not they had options to either file, serve, personally serve or whatever, but personally serve, subpoenas on
the language
subpoenas.
You're for.
Yeah. So on subpoenas, I'm saying on persons, on human beings, could have done that at any time from then forward, could have done a 30B6 deposition, could have done a number of things, have not. In practical terms, we probably end up getting the same documents being produced, or at least with some objections might get ruled on. But
you know, what concerns me about
issue.
All of this is, it, you know, the tension with Rule 1, you know, the speedy and inexpensive, among other things, determination of cases. If you can just have photocopies and make your opponent come to your own office and get the photocopies without all the rigmarole of a 30B6 deposition, all of that strikes me on the face of it, it's cheaper. If you can serve process through certified mail, you know, with a personal signature necessary so that the purpose of the rule that this doesn't slip by somebody is served, again, that's a cost-saving device. It's disturbing to see the rules applied in a way that makes them more expensive and clumsy.
Your Honor, my time's up. Can I answer the question?
You may, certainly.
Thank you. The key is to look at what the drafters of the rules looked for and wanted in these situations. And just recently, the Rules Committee looked, for example, at the personal service issue, and these same arguments were made. Gee, it would be a lot easier if we did certified mail. But the Rules Committee did not go with it.
Considering a comprehensive review, revision of Rule 45.
They are indeed. Quite comprehensive. But it's not there now, and it wasn't there when these were issued. So
okay,
we have
fine.
To live with what we have. Thank you.
You're quite right about that. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.